Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books in Medicine podcast, part of the New Books Network of Podcasts. I am your host, Jeremy Kaur, and today we will be talking to Dr. Eric Topol about his new book, Deep Medicine, How Artificial Intelligence Can Make Healthcare Human Again. Eric, thank you for joining us on the show today.
Great to be with you, Jeremy.
Can you begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm a cardiologist. I run the Scripps Research Translational Institute. That's part of Scripps Research here in La Jolla, California. I've been here about 12 and a half years, and it's the greatest because I get to do some innovative things with a remarkable team of over 100 people cutting across lots of different disciplines. So it's a fantastic place to be, and it helped to be the inspiration for the Deep Medicine book.
So can you dig into that a little bit more? What actually inspired you to write Deep Medicine?
You know, as you know, Jeremy, I've been working in the digital medical sphere for well over a dozen years. And it was clear that we were accumulating lots of data, but most of it was sitting in storage. Not anything meaningful was coming from it. And it was clear also that we were starting to see AI warm up in other sectors, whether it's with cars or with other industries, but not so much in healthcare. So about 3.5 years ago, I decided I was going to get into this space, learn about it, speak and hang out with a bunch of the AI gurus, because I'm not a computer scientist, and see where it would take us, where it could take us. And that's really what led to the book, because when I went into it, I really didn't know where I was headed, just that I thought it was going to be a great way to analyze data. I learned that it could do far more than that.
Can you explain artificial intelligence for our listeners that might not know a lot about it? And also, what exactly is deep medicine?
Yeah, well, firstly, artificial intelligence has been around for many decades. That's nothing new, really. The idea that you could get a machine with software to be intelligent, very kind of reductionist definition. In the last decade, the subtype of artificial intelligence called deep learning became validated largely through the work of Jeffrey Hinton, Jan LeCun, Yashua Bengio from University of Toronto, who were just awarded, by the way, the Turing Prize, which is the number one prize in all of computer science. And basically, a deep neural net, deep learning, is taking image or speech or text, taking data sets, putting it through layers of artificial neurons that are dictated by the complexity of the data, and then coming up with an output. So what that has done is enabled amazing processing at human or superhuman levels of performance, accuracy, and speed that are quite remarkable. And so that's what deep learning is. It's this really exciting form of AI. Without it, we couldn't really be talking about deep medicine. And when I mean deep medicine, I'm talking about having a lot of data about each person, big data, per individual, all the different layers, you know, biology, physiology, anatomy, environment, you know, all these different layers of data, and using deep learning to then get to a state of decompressing doctors' roles, making it more accurate, performance much better and efficient, productivity. So decompressing the mundane tasks, the outsourcing of things for doctors, and also empowering patients at the same time so that they can generate their data, have algorithms to support them. So then you start to get to deep empathy, which is the essence of deep medicine, as I call it. And that's the ability to have time, the gift of time, so that the patient-doctor relationship can be restored, because it's eroded so severely over the decades since I finished medical school.
So what is what you call shallow medicine, and how does it differ from deep medicine?
Yeah, well, that's what we got right now, unfortunately. Insufficient time, insufficient context, insufficient presence, and insufficient everything. I mean, it's really, we have 12 million errors a year. We have 7 minutes for return appointments, 12 minutes on average for a new patient. Doctors and clinicians are getting squeezed. We have burnout at unprecedented levels. 20% of doctors have clinical depression. Burnout causes a doubling of errors. We have profound waste and all sorts of unnecessary testing, because it's easier to order a test than it is to actually have time with patients and really try to delve into the problem. We don't have real listening. We don't even have really high quality physical exams because we don't have time. So shallow medicine is just error laden, and it's the degradation of the human bond, the precious presence that would occur if we let doctors be what they want to be, which is caring for patients. So shallow medicine as it exists today is largely a healthcare without the care.
What percentage of the healthcare delivered to the United States out there today is shallow medicine? Is it all shallow medicine? Is the majority of it? Are there some beacons of hope that are doing, you know, kind of what you talk about in the book?
Well, as you know, Jeremy, I start out the book by telling the story of my knee replacement, which is an exemplar of shallow medicine. Insufficient data by the surgeon in planning my postoperative course therapy. And the idea that, you know, when I went in with a horrible situation, I was told that I needed to take antidepressants. You know, I should see my internist. That's a robotic response. That's not a human response from a highly educated physician. That's shallow medicine, because it takes too much time to listen to somebody's problems. And it's a lot easier to prescribe pain medicines, which no wonder we have such an opiate epidemic. So, no, in answer to your question, I can't quantify it. I just know it's pervasive. I've experienced it, my family members, my friends, and so many patients who I get to see who have already been seen by another cardiologist or physician. I can tell that that's been part of the problem. And I go through some of those cases in the book to also show other examples.
If AI and technology are used more in medicine, I think one of the concerns a lot of people have, and maybe people that don't necessarily understand AI that much, they have the concern that there will be a even less personalized and a human feeling in their interactions with doctors. And, you know, what about jobs? Will a lot of the jobs in healthcare no longer be needed? Can you talk about a little bit about kind of the common concerns you hear about this?
Yeah, I think that when you have 7 minutes with a patient, and we know that if a doctor doesn't have the diagnosis in mind in the first 5 minutes from system one thinking, which is, you know, the Danny Kahneman's thinking fast and slow. If it isn't in the mind, doesn't come to the, you know, reflexive in the first 5 minutes, then there's a 70-odd% error rate in making the diagnosis. So if you only have 7 minutes with a patient and you're pecking on a keyboard, because the role of clinicians have become data clerks. And this is the biggest explanation for why there's such, you know, terrific, horrendous burnout. And by the way, you know, Abraham Verghese, who I regard as the number one medical humanist of our era, he wrote the foreword for the book, and he and I are completely aligned on this issue about explaining why there is such profound disenchantment. And it doesn't take much to be in touch with that throughout the medical community.
I actually saw him speak at a conference, and it was a very powerful experience. How can AI be utilized to help with medical diagnoses?
Well, that's the easy part. Relatively easy compared with restoring humanity of healthcare. But what we have seen now with deep learning is taking images, whether it be, you know, any type of medical scan, if you want to put in speech so you can get a beautiful note so you don't have to peck on a keyboard, liberation from keyboard, or you want to have machine vision during, let's say, colonoscopy so you don't miss polyps. So all these ways to take what is commonly interpreted patterns, whether it be radiologists or pathologists for slides or gastroenterologists or cardiologists, every single specialty, every single walk of life in medicine can have performance improved, accuracy far better. I mean, a perfect example, Jeremy, is radiologists. They have an overall 32% rate of false negatives, missing things like a pulmonary nodule that could be cancers on a chest X-ray, or many other things that are missed because the speed with which a radiologist has to go through 50 to 100 cases a day of films, many of them having innumerable subfiles. So what this is all about is, you know, outsourcing to machines, and we can train machines to have remarkable accuracy. And then it's overreading by physicians and clinicians, and that just makes life easier. So that's where all this is headed, and there's already some great examples in ophthalmology, dermatology, radiology, you know, many convincing, compelling examples.
You just mentioned it, but one of the big catchphrases people hear when AI is discussed is deep learning. What exactly is that? And can you talk a little bit more about how it works?
Yeah, I mentioned that that's a subtype of AI, and it's the one subtype which is really about using layers of artificial neurons, where as an image or text or speech goes through these layers, it just keeps getting, the features getting more and more and more defined until you get the output. So this is, as it turns out, an extraordinary type of AI, because it is the one form of AI that's now been shown to get this level of performance that is exceeding expert humans. And so it's a neural network, and it's basically, you know, it could be thousands of layers. It's just dependent on how, what kind of data you're putting in. And unlike humans, it has insatiable appetite for data. The more you put in with these ground truths when you're training a deep neural net. So let's say you're going to train on chest X-ray. Well, you want to put in a million chest X-rays that have been interpreted by experts with consensus. So it's not just one expert. It's a real consensus. It's a so-called ground truth. And most of what we have in AI is this form of supervised learning. We're not just putting in films and asking the neural net to interpret it. We're training based on the a large, you know, at scale experience of these so-called ground truths. And these basically then can you let loose the neural net once you've trained it and validated it, and then you can show that it can do this exceptionally well, better than humans. And it's basically embedding the expertise of a large number of humans into an algorithm. And that's what's really quite extraordinary.
What are some of the biggest concerns related to AI and your thoughts around them? Can you talk about jobs and even like the concept of driverless cars? For example, you know, people get in car accidents all the time, but when driverless cars get into an accident, it's a big deal because it's a new thing. People don't have it happen as much. That's going to be the same thing when AI fails to diagnose something that human error people are used to. But when AI makes a mistake, is that going to be enough to get concern around the AI made an error? It's not perfect. We need that human intervention there. It's not perfect yet. I mean, I'm probably not explaining this the right way, but I think you know what I'm getting at. Can you talk a little bit about that? And then on the other extreme, the future of AI, what about, and you do mention this in your book, but what about killer robots and things like that?
Yeah, well, as you know, in the book, there's a chapter called Deep Liabilities. And I get into all these points that you're touching on. They include the methodology of the algorithm development and the ethics and the inequities that we could make worse, which are already a big problem, particularly in the U.S. The existential threats, the jobs, the black box, lack of explainability, the privacy, security. There are no shortage of liabilities here. I think we can agree upon that. But none of those worry me the most. And that includes the bias, the human bias that goes into the deep learning nets as they get developed. But what bothers me the most is the missed opportunity here. And that is bringing back the humanity, humaneness in medicine. Because there are all these things that you're mentioning, and I just reviewed, there is a solution for them. But the one thing that's the hardest nut to crack is the gift of time to give that back to the patient-doctor relationship, to restore trust, presence, the precious human bond. And in the default mode, which is to squeeze clinicians as much as we can, which is what we live in now, and we suffer from that, the default mode will make this thing worse. So in order for us to derive the real benefits of AI, it means standing up and being activists. All of us in the medical community, all of us in patients, we need to train administrators more than the machines to make this happen.
What is what you call augmented individualized medical support, and what are some of the ways that it can affect different specialties?
Well, that's the patient side of the story. And that is, once you have data that's obviously it's digitized and it's now inputs, all your inputs being used through a deep learning algorithm and other means of AI, like natural language processing, it's going through this neural net to then give you feedback. And we're talking about multimodal data input. So, for example, the mode of your sensors, the mode of all your electronic records, the mode of your genomics or your gut microbiome analysis, or all these different, your environmental sensors, all these different data inputs are now through your smartphone, through an avatar, through just texting or through audio, is giving you feedback about your health. And that's really extraordinary, because now we have, for specific conditions, let's say diabetes or high blood pressure or you name the condition, we have a way to get an auto loop of feedback to each individual. Eventually, as I wrote in the book, there's a chapter called The Virtual Medical Assistant, and that'll promote overall health. And the dream, of course, is something we've never actualized, is true prevention on an individualized basis. because the algorithm will be processing all your data, knows what your risks are, and tries to prevent the condition, let's say asthma, or let's say progression to diabetes or heart disease or whatever it is. It's using your data and the known corpus of the medical literature and all the things that are happening in your life to try to prevent what otherwise would occur and, you know, change the natural history in you. So that's really exciting. That's a longer term story, but we're already seeing in specific conditions like diabetes that this is occurring.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Can you dig into that a little bit more on how patients' daily lives will be affected in terms of things like managing their diet or even asking questions about different health concerns to a patient's smartphone?
Yeah, well, you know, the diet one is a chapter I devoted to that because it is so extraordinary. I mean, people really want to know how they can make what they eat promote their health. I mean, that's something wouldn't it be nice if we had our diet that replaced the need for medications, help prevent illnesses that we otherwise would be at risk for developing. So what's amazing about this, Jeremy, is that a group in Israel led by Aaron Siegel at the Weizmann Institute, a few years ago, they cracked the case about individualized diet. They used a glucose sensor as the endpoint. And they showed that if we all ate the exact same thing, the exact same amount, the exact same time, our resultant glucose in our blood through the sensor would be all over the map. And when you start collecting all your data, as I did in this experiment, and that includes, you know, your sleep, your physical activity, your everything you eat and drink, your medications, all time stamped, and your glucose sensor and your gut microbiome analysis, it's only through analyzing all this data do we understand that there is true individual response to food, and that you can get food that would in you prevent a glucose spike. Now, we don't know whether that alone is the end all, because we don't even know if that prevents progression of diabetes. Intuitively, maybe, but we don't know if you ablate these glucose spikes by following the food recommendation for you, whether that really works. But now the same thing has been shown for triglycerides with machine learning. So this individual response to what we eat and guiding the best foods for each individual rather than these guidelines, pyramids that are just based on the simplistic notion that all of us should be eating the same food. Everyone should be on a ketone diet or a paleo diet or whatever diet is really wrong. And I think to try to discover that through trial and error rather than through AI, the latter is where we're headed. So that's diet, but it cuts through, you know, for supporting the avoidance of depression or better managing depression with all these objective measures like voice, which is rich with data about one's state of mind, your respiratory pattern, there's so many features, how you type on your smartphone keyboard or a computer keyboard, and on and on about all these objective features, how you can get to a state of a person's mind, their mood, and that can help in monitoring mental health, and whether that's to avoid depression or have better management of someone who has been manifesting depression. So there's all sorts of things you can do when you can process data in a meaningful way, accurately, quickly, you know, when it's validated. So, you know, the opportunities are seemingly limitless.
What are some of the other ways that AI has and could have an impact on mental health, and if so, how?
Well, besides these objective measures that I just touched on, there's a lot more, you know, facial recognition, vital signs, you know, there's a lot there, at, you know, how much physical activity and how much communication you engage in. But the other big part of the story for mental health is the recognition that people would rather talk to an avatar with their innermost secrets over a human being, that is a counselor or a psychologist, psychiatrist, a mental health professional. Now that's rich because we can make a lot more avatars that are interactive than we have as a supply of trained mental health professionals. In fact, the mismatch is, you know, really out of kilter. So when we learn that, and it's been confirmed by other studies, and it wasn't anticipated, now we can build these modes of supporting people by having the unbridled communication to an avatar. Again, all this assumes that we've got this privacy and security issue fully on track, guarded for the benefit of the individual. But that goes to show that you can do so much without the human support, and can be done inexpensively, effectively. And in preliminary data from small randomized studies, even with a chatbot, which is a primitive form of this, using text, not really with an interactive avatar. But, you know, it's encouraging. We have a lot more to do. And everything we're talking about is what I would call in the early stages. It still requires mostly prospective studies and rigorous trials. They're getting done now in many aspects, including mental health, but a lot of them are still pending.
Let's shift back a bit to talking about how AI can assist doctors. Can you talk about how it can assist them in assessing things like skin cancer, and how accurate and reliable is that?
Well, the skin cancer has been now not just replicated, but triplicated. You know, there's three big studies. They're all retrospective, which is a limitation. They need to go prospective, meaning in a real clinical environment, rather than in big data sets where they have ground truths. And so melanoma has been the main target, although it's extended to basal cell carcinoma and other skin cancers. But basically, whether it was the Stanford study with 21 Stanford board-certified dermatologists, or the European study of 58 experienced dermatologists, or yet another third study, all of them have shown that if you have a high-quality picture of a skin lesion, question cancer, you can accurately diagnose it as well by an algorithm, if not better, than by dermatologists. Now, why is that important? Well, obviously, you want to catch these skin cancers accurately, not with false alarms. And we don't have enough dermatologists, and a lot of primary care doctors are not going to be able to diagnose this as accurately as we'd like. Plus, you know, why not people have self-diagnosis through their phone? That's where this is headed, because you can take high-quality pictures through your phone, get an algorithm to tell you that this is suspicious, or not to worry with, you know, accurate results. We haven't seen that yet. We're not there, but those are being developed right now.
What role does artificial intelligence have in medical research? Could it help to do things like discover new drugs? Can machine learning and artificial intelligence outperform humans in this area?
Well, again, there's a chapter. It's called Deep Discovery. And I get into all the things in science, in life science. Drug discovery is one part. Every aspect of drug discovery, whether it's mining all the data that's out there, whether it's looking at prediction of dose or combinations or side effects, so you don't have to do preclinical testing with animals, all sorts of things, simulations. But the biggest thing to me is what we've seen in life science, so upending the microscope. So you don't have to use stains, where we know when you use fluorescence, you actually damage the cells. That in itself affects the interpretation. Or hematoxylin and eosin, H&E preps. You don't have to do that because you can train looking at slides without any stains to have accurate interpretations through algorithms. And then there's rare cells that, you know, we couldn't find them and diagnose them at scale accurately. And now we have ghost cytometry, which is, you know, AI, cancer biology, genomics, neuroscience. Every one of these fields has been markedly facilitated by being able to process massive data sets and substitute for the routine things that occur. And so it's an across the board thing. In the science side, discovery side, it's moving much faster because it doesn't require, you know, regulatory approvals by FDA or prospective trials. I mean, these are really compelling evidence that we have new ways of doing things.
How can AI have an effect on medicine at the health system level?
Well, got a chapter on that too. There, it's really fascinating because there's many different types of AI use at a health system level. One of them is for prediction. And prediction is, in my view, kind of a soft spot for AI right now because it's trying to predict everything, like if you're in the hospital, whether you're going to die and whether you're going to have a short stay, long stay, readmission. And then all the other things like Alzheimer's, sepsis, and just survival overall. If you look at all the data, it's all over the map. And I tell a story about my father-in-law who basically any algorithm would have said he was dead or just about, you know, dead. And that's why he was set up to be taken to our home to die. And in the morning that he was to do that, he woke up. He was resurrected. So we have issues with using algorithms, but health systems are going to start relying on these more to know where to put their resources to avoid readmissions, for example. And they're already starting to be used in certain health systems. Of course, health systems will benefit by the higher productivity and workflow. But one of the big things is machine vision. Fei-Fei Li and Arnie Milstein in Stanford, Palo Alto, working with Intermountain Health in Salt Lake, have shown recently how machine vision can be so helpful, for example, in the intensive care unit, to tell whether or not a patient is about to pull their endotracheal tube out before it comes out so that it's a much safer environment to be able to predict falls in patients, you know, who are in the hospital. Who by machine vision, it's predicted that they're getting wobbly and things that would have been missed by nurses and other personnel. Hand washing is another example, using machine vision of healthcare personnel, surgeons in the hospital setting to know that it's not been adequate, it's not by protocol. So wherever you look in a hospital, there's ways to improve safety, to decrease reliance on on human resources, and, you know, make things less costly as well. So a lot of promise at the health system level.
We touched on this earlier, and it's ultimately in the title of your book, but how can artificial intelligence bring empathy and human interaction back into healthcare to improve both provider and patient satisfaction?
Well, there's the two big impacts. One is at the doctor-clinician level, which is outsourcing so much that's done today by that individual, be it data clerk functions or trying to review, get their arms around a big mass of chart data, electronic and or paper. So that decompression is one big part of this. The other is the patients taking on more charge because they are generating their data and they have algorithmic support. And ideally they own all their data because the more of those inputs that are theirs is going to help the algorithm for the best possible output. Anyway, when you have both of these clicking, you then can get to deep medicine because you have the gift of time. You have the true presence, the true listening to a patient, their story. Every one of those stories are individualized. You reestablish the trust, the sense that a person is being cared and looked after. You restore the mission of why people went into healthcare in the first place, which was to do that rather than to be pecking at a keyboard and burdened with all sorts of administrative stuff, where voice note, that is, conversation, can engender a note far better than what is an Epic and Cerner and current healthcare information system. So we're getting to the point that you can see through where this will take, and we can get the human bond reestablished that used to be there decades ago, before the business of medicine derailed it.
So while researching this book, what of the upcoming technologies or ways AI will be used in the future did you find to be the most exciting or interesting?
Well, I mean, all of AI, it's the paradox, right? The counterintuitive, that technology to enhance humanity, but all the things we've been talking about, being able to take language, being able to take data at scale and get it interpreted in an extraordinary way. But the complementarity of what algorithms can do and what humans can do, it's not either or, it's the synergy that makes this so powerful. So, you know, every way you look at it, there's just extraordinary potential. There's also been, unfortunately, you know, extraordinary hype. But as I try to dissect all this, I think that we have a path now to rescue what has been the biggest problems in healthcare today. And they're not just in the U.S. I mean, I just spent the last year and a half commissioned by the U.K. government to help review and plan the future of the NHS, particularly how to use AI and genomics and digital medicine to see how it would affect the workforce and to make medicine more efficient. And as we concluded in a report that's open access, the gift of time is the greatest gift we can get out of that. So what the troubles we have are different in the UK than here in the US because of the single payer and the fact that it's egalitarian and every citizen of the UK has healthcare. But there is the commonality of losing touch, the keyboards, administrative burdens, and the lack of sense of care that patients have because they barely have eye contact, no less the time, no less the humanity that's vital to move forward.
Well, Eric, I've taken up a lot of your time today. My final question for you is, what are you working on now?
Well, we as a institute are working a lot in AI and in genomics, especially to rev up the interpretation and accuracy and lower the cost of whole genome sequencing. But we're also using it in sensors like in heart rhythm and other types of what we call time series analysis of sensors. We have a big partnership with NVIDIA that was started just 6 months ago. We also are leading a big part of the Precision Medicine Initiative, which is 1 million Americans who are essentially going to be getting multimodal data. And eventually, you know, having that supported, they will have all their data. It will be supported by algorithms. And over the years ahead, they will be a great testing ground for where individualized medicine is headed. So that keeps us busy. I think trying to see through the exciting path going forward and trying to ignite the activism that's going to be needed in order for us to achieve a deep form of medicine.
Well, Eric, I want to thank you very, very much for your time today. I really appreciated it, and look forward to having you back on the show again in the future.
Okay, Jeremy. Thanks a lot. Great to talk with you.